From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. We all remember a Tunisian fruit vendor set himself on fire to protest his humiliation by police, and a spark spread across the Arab world. A strong man out, and elections in Egypt, upheaval in Yemen, war in Lebanon, Libya, much more. But where are we now? Huge death tolls still emerging from Syria, women marching in their thousands in Egypt this week against the military and mistreatment, conservative Islam moving to the fore. This hour on Point, the year of the Arab Spring. You can join the conversation. What was unleashed, unlocked this year in the Arab world? Where is it going? And did you see the shocking image from Cairo of a woman stripped and beaten this week by Egyptian soldiers? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I apologize for my voice. I'm doing the best I can today. Here from February 11th. Early in the year, who can forget, Tahrir Square in Cairo erupting here in celebration after it was announced that Hosni Mubarak would step down as president. Here, one Egyptian man spoke about the promise of that moment, that night.
We're 30 years old. We never experienced something called an ex-president. It's something we have never experienced. We're so high on that feeling right now. We're not thinking even of the future, but we're very sure the future is going to be better. Egypt is going to be a better place. My wife is pregnant, and I'm really proud that my kid is going to be born in a new Egypt.
It's going to be a better place, and maybe it will, maybe it is, but it has not been easy. Death and protests and military still in the streets just this last weekend. On Tuesday, thousands of women marched through the streets of Cairo to protest the mistreatment of women by the Egyptian military. Many carried pictures of that woman who was captured on video being stripped and beaten by military police. The girls of Egypt are here. They said, drag me, strip me, my brother's blood will cover me. And here on state television over the weekend, military-appointed Egyptian Prime Minister Kamal al-Ghazouri spoke out against the protesters.
Egypt today is in front of you, and you have to protect Egypt. What we're having today is not a revolution. It's an attack against the revolution.
And, of course, it's not just about Egypt. We have an entire region still very much in the throes of something enormous going on. We're going to look at that today. We have an embarrassment of riches on our panel. From Doha, Qatar, Shadi Hamid joins us, Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center, a fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy. Shadi, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
From Beirut, Lebanon, Rami Khoury is here, internationally syndicated columnist, editor-at-large at Beirut's Daily Star newspaper, director of the Institute of Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. Rami Khoury, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And from Oklahoma City, Anthony Shadid joins us, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for the New York Times, has deeply covered the Iraq War and this region, held captive this year in Libya. His book, House of Stone, A Memoir of Home, Family, and a Lost Middle East, is due out in March. Anthony Shadid, welcome. Always great to have you with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Let's just go around the horn here and get from each of you. Rami, let me come first to you. Just stepping way back from this, what is it that has happened this year? We'll get into particulars, but what has happened this year in the Arab world, and where does that happening stand now?
Well, what's happened simply is that we've started to experience something which most countries experience at their birth, but the Arabs didn't. What we're experiencing is a process of citizen participation and national self-determination. It's a very simple process. Arab citizens now are beginning to feel that they have the power and the rights to shape their country, their values, their policies, and this is a process that has been denied to them across the region without any serious exceptions, has been denied to them effectively for the last two or three generations, and this is now turning around. So we're starting to see a historic process of national self-determination at the broadest level.
You say it's a very simple process, but tell that to the crowds in Syria that have been mowed down just this week, 100 and plus in a single day. Tell that to the women in the streets of Cairo. I mean, it looks anything but simple from outside, Rami.
Well, what I mean by simple, I mean, I don't mean it's easy. It's very hard, and thousands died and will die, as they have. And look at the American Revolution. Look at the battle for liberty in Europe. Look what happened in all over the world, where countries battle for their freedom and people become self-determinant and sovereign and free. These are violent processes in most cases. And like I said, these things normally happen at the beginning of the life of a sovereign state. In the Arab world, that didn't happen because we had peculiar births at the hands of European midwives, and there wasn't a natural process of either state formation or national identity or policy setting. None of these things happened in a natural way in the Arab world because the region was quickly dominated either by European-picked royal families or military coups. But all that is now being slowly, slowly overturned, but the process is violent. It's ugly. It's three generations of resentments that are coming out, and so we will naturally see in some countries like Syria will be more difficult than countries like Tunisia.
Shadi Hamid in Doha, step back for us. Give us your perspective on the big picture of what is happening this year and where it stands.
Sure. Well, I think one thing that we've learned from the Arab revolts is that stability is an illusion. That if you have the U.S. and other Western powers, and even the autocrats themselves had this notion that their regimes were durable, that they would last. But I think what we've learned now is that what seems impossible can become possible very quickly. No one saw Tunisia coming. There's not one Middle East analyst in the world who predicted Tunisia. Tunisia was actually thought to be the most stable of the Arab autocracies. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lesson going forward that, you know, people are saying it's not going to happen there. It's not going to happen here. It's Saudi Arabia. No, I mean, autocracies are by definition temporary. So sooner or later, it's going to happen everywhere. It's just a matter of time. So I think we have to prepare ourselves for that. And by now, it's very much a cliche, but yes, democratic transitions are notoriously difficult. They're messy, and there's a trade-off between stability and democratization. In the short term, in many of these countries, things are going to be unstable. They are going to be bloody. But I think what the people on the ground would say is that it's worth it. And the process has to start sometime, and we're starting it now.
Shadi, you have written that Islamists are the future. One of your big takeaways from this year. What do you mean?
You know, I think there were a lot of people, especially in the U.S. and Europe, who I think deceived themselves into thinking that these were secular or liberal revolutions. They weren't. And I think that was a real misconception right from the start. They were non-ideological, but that doesn't mean they were secular. And Islamist parties, wherever there are free elections in the Arab world, are going to win. It's that simple, and it's something that the world is going to have to accept. It's something that Egyptian liberals are going to have to accept. And we have to find a way to incorporate these parties in the political process, and that's something that's already started in Tunisia, which now has an Islamist prime minister, in Morocco, which now has an Islamist prime minister. And we're seeing major electoral victories from the various Islamist parties in Egypt. Arabs are religiously conservative, and that's just the way that it is. And if you look at all the polling, Arabs want Islam and Islamic law to play a larger role in public life. And the numbers are astounding. We're talking about 80 to 90% of the populations in many of these countries. Now, there's disagreement about what that means in practice, and that's what's going to be so fascinating about the coming period, is how do you integrate that desire for Islam and Islamic law to play a larger role in everyday politics?
Anthony Shadid, far from the region on this day, back in the U.S. For a few days here in Oklahoma, you've said it's hard to draw conclusions about what it is that we've just seen and where it's going, but give us your best shot, Tony. Here we are standing at the end of this epical year for this region that you and Rami and Shadi know so well. What do you see unfolding?
Well, I think, you know, Rami and Shadi are exactly right. I think we are going to see, you know, especially next year, a potentially prolonged period of uncertainty and stability as these uprisings, revolts, revolutions, however we want to describe them, reach their fruition. You know, what strikes me so much over the past year, I guess, are two things. One is this kind of crumbling or collapse of an order that anchored the region for so long. And I think we see the region itself in terms of its foreign policy, alliances, rivalries, everything kind of up in the air, everything in play at this point. And I think when we turn to the more domestic issues, we see this kind of struggle over notions of citizenship. And I think Shadi touched on that. We are seeing an entry in a legitimate fashion of Islamists into the political, the mainstream politics of these countries. And I think that's a startling moment for the Arab world. You know, Shadi pointed out some of the challenges I think you're going to see within those societies, Tunisia, Morocco, Libya, Egypt, potentially Syria. But I think we're also going to see, you know, hopefully we'll see a decision by the West on how they want to engage these political systems as the Islamists make a very forceful entry into them democratically. Are we going to see something like we saw in Algeria or the Palestinian territories with Hamas's electoral victory? Are we going to see something more engaged, more in some ways more positive that tries to bring these societies forward? I think that's going to be a real challenge for the West.
Do you think, Anthony, that the West is necessarily disadvantaged or put back on its heels by the rise of civic Islam here?
Well, I think, you know, I think a lot of people abroad saw what happened back in December, January, February in places like Tunisia and Egypt. You know, Shadi said that they saw them as secular. I mean, I think it was in some ways kind of an inchoate, you know, eruption of discontent and disenchantment. Absolutely, though, the aftermath of these revolts has played to the most organized groups within those societies, and those are the Islamists, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, the party in Tunisia, the list goes on. I think it's going to be a real challenge how the West perceives that, if they're going to stick to kind of old notions of how they've dealt with Islamists, or if they're going to try to embrace something and acknowledge the change in the political systems that we're seeing in these countries.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the year of the Arab Spring and where the wave of change stands at year's end. It has been an epical year from this region. With us today from Oklahoma City, Anthony Shadi, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, author of the forthcoming House of Stone, has covered this region inside and out. From Beirut, Lebanon, Rami Khoury is with us, editor-at-large at Beirut's Daily Star newspaper. From Doha, Qatar, Shadi Hamid is with us, director of research in the Brookings Doha Center. Here it is, February 11th in Tahrir Square, when it was announced that Hosni Mubarak would be stepping down. Rami Khoury, you sat with us here in the United States, and we watched that night. It was incredible, the people, the overwhelming emotion, that moment. But then, just this week, here we are, have opposition groups saying that more than 160 people killed by troops in a small town in northwestern Syria on Tuesday. Here's tape of Ala al-Din al-Yusuf, a Syrian opposition member, calling in to Al Jazeera to describe the killings this week.
It was a massacre in Azawiya Mountain, and we've lost 100 martyrs. Civilians were surrounded by forces in a valley west of Kafrawin. The civilians were left for more than 4 hours asking for help without any response. The corpses of those killed were on the streets and in the mosque, and we are not allowed to bury any of them.
The killing has been fierce. It's gone on, and that happening even as you had outside groups coming into Syria to look at what was going on there, the killing going on anyway. Anthony Shadid, I know you're on a short break from the region, but I wish you'd just give us a little bit of a quick, you know, country-by-country status here, just the thumbnail. I mean, we've seen so many, and it's hard for Americans to keep up with what's happened. Where, if you can just start with Tunisia and take us across In the sort of briefest description, where do things stand in terms of this wave?
Well, I mean, I think what we see in Egypt and Tunisia is at least an electoral process that's underway. I think we see something that you can see a path forward. Not that it's going to be easy, not that it's going to be absent of crisis and confrontation. I think especially in Egypt, as the military and an empowered parliament move forward, there is going to be a clash over relative weight of power of each institution going forward. Bahrain, you've seen a crackdown that in some ways devastated the society, tore it apart so that it could put down the uprising and maintain the power of a
with the help of Saudis and others from outside.
Absolutely. And with, I think what critics there would see is American complicity in that crackdown. I think Yemen is in a very, uncertain state as the president there, Ali Abdullah Saleh, has agreed to resign, but he still casts a long shadow over that society. And then I think with most people, the real worry out there is Syria. Where does Syria go next year? How does, what shape does the uprising take? And also what does the government do, or the leadership, let's say, to maintain its power? I think there's a deep worry in the region that Syria is most combustible of any crisis, and that has the potential to spill beyond Syria's borders.
We'll look more deeply at that one. Shadi, think with us for a moment about Egypt. Christos writes in on Facebook and says, meet the new boss in Egypt, same as the old boss. Paolo writes, the U.S. media is paying obligatory lip service to the Egyptian protesters while the U.S. government continues backing the military. What about the U.S. in Egypt, just for one, Shadi Hamid? I mean, we were slow. We finally came around. Then they said, okay, Mubarak should go, but it took a lot of time in the streets. And who is the United States really allied with in the balance of the year?
Well, first of all, if there was any doubt about it before, there shouldn't be any doubt now. Egypt's military council, which is now ruling, is the single biggest threat to Egyptian democracy. No one comes a close second. So I hope that is dawning on people in the region and certainly in the U.S. Unfortunately, however, the U.S. does not have a good history when it comes to autocratic forces in Egypt. I mean, we supported the Mubarak regime for 3 decades with billions and billions of dollars. And I think there was hope, finally, that we would have learned from that lesson. But it doesn't seem like we have. There has been, various statements from U.S. officials expressing concern, criticizing the military's conduct, but there has to be more than that now. And that means playing hardball with the Egyptian military. The U.S. gives them $1.3 billion annually. That gives the Obama administration leverage. Now is the time to use it.
But let me ask you, one of our listeners, St. Paulo, also says, along these lines, he says, the only two possible results in Egypt are that the Islamists are voted in and they purge the Egyptian military, or the military continues to crush protesters with increasing brutality. Is he right? And if so, how does the United States get into that calculus?
Okay, well, there is another option. There is a middle course that there is already supposed to be a transition process underway. When the military deposed Mubarak and took power, they said that they were willing to return to the barracks after a certain amount of time. So we're only holding them to their own rhetoric. I think there is a way to persuade the military through pressure internally and externally that they can play a very important role in Egypt's future in terms of protecting the nation from external threats, but they should not be in the business of day-to-day governing. I think there is a way to reach that arrangement. It's going to take time. There will be a lot of back and forth, but that's precisely why the U.S. role here is so important. I mean, the U.S. is the primary external funder of Egypt's military. We provide them with at least 20% of their budget. That's a remarkable figure right there. So you'd think that we'd be willing to use that. Unfortunately, however, we were very late to act in February. We only really supported the protesters' aspirations very late in the game. And so there isn't a great track record there. And I think we're falling back into the same holding pattern of the devil we know is better than the devil we don't. We have a relationship with the military. We work with them. We know them. We're afraid of the Islamists who are rising now. So we're falling back into this pattern of siding with quote-unquote stability.
But you and Rami certainly, maybe Tony as well, will ask, but seem to describe that as being on the wrong side of history or inevitability here. Let's bring our callers in. Radwan, calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Radwan, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Great show.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Hey, I kind of want to touch on what I'm hearing from a lot of the callers or a lot of your speakers, mm-hmm. which is it's a great opportunity, particularly as we imagine how the West engages all that's going on in the Arab world, Egypt particularly. It's an opportunity for the West to kind of reimagine its role in the foreign policy and take a chance to align our foreign policy in that region with our core values of democracy. I think a lot of times, and I've heard this said different ways, we value stability often in the form of autocracy, and it seems to give us short-term relief But in the long term, the 25, the 30, the 45 years, it always comes back at us.
Radwan, let me ask you. You talk about American core values and foreign policy. Can American core values and foreign policy be aligned with, work with, Islamist governments? If that's what's coming here, Radwan, what do you think?
Sure. I mean, I think Turkey's a classic example of that. Turkey's an example of a secular state, in large part headed by a principally Islamic party. We have fantastic relations. I think the opportunity for us now is to engage early, engage often with these parties so that we can help fundamentally shape and form the outlook of those parties rather than always be on the side of autocracy and then getting caught with our pants down that now the party that's in place is the party that we resisted for the longest. We never engaged them. And so their principal outlook towards the U.S. is one of confrontation because we were never engaged.
Radwan, you're keen on this. Rami Curry, let me bring it to you in Beirut. How does the West / the U.S., maybe just the U.S., deal with the rise of Islamist civic political power, on the backside of this revolution? And can these? How does this work together, Rami?
Well, I think this is a real moment of a new start for any foreign power, as well as being a new start for the people of the Arab world. And I think, first of all, there's way too much attention being given to the American reaction. I think the Americans now are marked by a very unusual brand of sort of irrelevance and marginalization in the Middle East. The Americans are physically pulling out of the area militarily, and politically they've been self-marginalized for about 2-3 years. And they've reacted to this wave of Arab revolts with a consistent combination of confusion and inconsistent reactions. That one day they say we want stability, then they support Democrats. So this is really a moment where the U.S. has to either cook or get out of the kitchen.
But aren't we bolted right into it, Rami, in between oil and Israel and, you know, all the other interests that flow through this region? Isn't the U.S. sort of...
Well, oil and Israel and the other interests will be best served by a democratic and sovereign Arab region. And this is the whole point, that the U.S. has to decide if it really is committed to democracy, then the democratic process needs a transition period, which, like the U.S. realized with its own civil war and other problems, takes time and can be rough. But the ultimate goal is worth it. The reality is that the Islamists in the Arab world are a transitional group. They're not going to be forever running the place. The second thing is they're incumbent. They have legitimacy. They have incumbency, and they are accountable to the entire population. This has never happened before. So these are not the same Islamists that we knew 10 or 20 years ago. And I think the focus on the U.S. and the focus on the Islamists at both poles of this process is vastly exaggerated. The focus should be on incumbent, legitimate, democratically elected political groups in these countries. Democracy and legitimacy are the should be the focal points. If an Islamist or a tribal leader or a lefty, progressive, secular person wins, they have to be given the chance to govern, and the U.S. should support that. The point is it's been marginalized precisely because it's been so inconsistent and so hypocritical. And this is really a moment of reckoning for the United States.
It has certainly been Arabs themselves fully out front in this year of the Arab Spring. There's no question about it. Janice in Natick, Massachusetts. Janice, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hello to your excellent panelists. My question is, with the popular voice finally being heard in the Arab Spring, many of us want to know, what are the implications toward freedom and peace for Palestinians?
Anthony Shadid, let me bring that one to you in Oklahoma City.
Well, I think there's no question that the foreign policies of these countries are going to reflect their populations to a greater extent, and there's a deep degree of support for Palestinian aspirations to statehood, and there's no question these foreign policies are going to reflect that. I think Egypt in particular often either implicitly or explicitly sided with American and Israeli foreign policy in the region. It's going to be difficult to see that going forward. It's just not tenable anymore. Now, what does that lead to in practical terms, I think, is a different question. I think what you're going to see is countries that are closer to Israel end up making maybe not the compromises that were made in the past, but still, you know, reach some kind of working relationship. I think their priorities are going to be the economy. Their priorities are going to be building political systems at home. I think foreign policy is going to be seen as kind of, you know, adventurous, and that's not something that these new governments, at least, are going to want to spend too much time on. So, to be honest, I think we're going to hear a lot more noise, but in terms of what we see shift on the ground, it's probably not going to be all that all that different than what we've seen in the past.
Shadi Hamid, are you so confident? I mean, there's a strong element of populism, of course, in popular uprisings and these movements. Might that not put pressure on their governments to change their policy in sharp ways with Israel?
I mean, no doubt about it. I wouldn't want to be Israel right now. Let's be honest about it. I mean, Arabs hate Israel. They would rather it not be there if they had the choice. That said, I think you have to distinguish between what people want in theory and what they're willing to accept in reality. So there is going to be, I think, a willingness to at least coexist with Israel. There is going to be tension, as Anthony said. There's no doubt about that. But I think if we take a longer-term perspective, this is really a sea shift in the balance of power in the region, because you have this emerging Sunni Islamist bloc, let's call it, in Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, possibly Syria, maybe add in Morocco at some point, and as well as Turkey, which has been playing a kind of superpower role in the region. So you have this new bloc of powers that are neither with the U.S., nor are they with the kind of resistance axis of Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah. So they're going to be more assertive, they're going to be more nationalist, and they're going to be pushing their interests more aggressively. And I think if you look at the Palestinian issue, I think Palestinians now have less incentive to compromise because they see these emerging governments offering them more rhetorical support, and they feel that Israel is more and more isolated. So I think there's a real shift that's going on there. And when you feel that history is on your side, as I think Palestinians do, certainly now, then they can wait. They can wait. There's less of a rush to make compromises in the short term.
Rami Khoury, is there a new way here for Israel, for the Palestinians, a viable new way given these regional realities, Rami?
I think there's no doubt that more democratic and legitimate Arab governments will reflect their public opinion. Public opinion in the Arab world is critical of what Israel is doing in terms of its policies, its colonization, its imprisoning thousands of Palestinians, expropriating lands, shooting people, etc. But at the same time, Arab public opinion is committed to a negotiated, reasonable, and equitable permanent peace agreement. The Arab world is prepared to live with an Israeli state. It is not prepared to live with a colonial Zionist.
What makes you so sure that the Arab world, that is a writ so large, is committed to a negotiated, peaceful path?
I think we see this from public opinion polling. We've seen it in government positions, though governments don't always reflect their people, we know. And we've seen it I've lived here for the last 45 years,
yep,
talking around the region. People are willing to live with an Israeli state that is willing to live with a Palestinian state and resolve the Palestinian issue on the basis of equal rights for Israelis and Palestinians. I think the question is not about the Arabs. The question is about the Israelis. They're the ones who are colonizing land and building settlements and imprisoning Palestinians. So we really need to know from the Israelis, are they prepared to respond constructively? It's quite ironic, I think, that Mohammed Bouazizi was kind of a Rosa Parks moment when one person sparked this mass movement. And the Rosa Parks analogy is fascinating because in Israel today, you have buses that are segregating men and women because of religious pressure from right-wing extremists in Israel. So there's a Bull Connor moment in Israel, while the Arabs have a Rosa Parks moment. So I think we really need to ask about the Israelis and their policies and what is the United States' sentiment about that, as much as we ask about what is the U.S. thinking about Islamists. The Arabs have a peace plan on the table. We're ready to sit and live with the Israelis according to international norms. We haven't had a response to that from the Israelis or the Americans for decades.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the year of the Arab Spring at that year's end and where the wave of change stands as we approach 2012 now with a terrific panel here today. Shadi Hamid from Doha, Qatar joins us from the Brookings Doha Center. Director of Research there, Rami Khoury with Beirut's Daily Star joins us, and Anthony Shadid, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent, author of the upcoming House of Stone, a memoir of home, family, and a lost Middle East, himself captive in Libya during hot days there over the summer. Meher is calling from Boston. Meher, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. My point might be a repetition of an earlier discussion you had, but I just wanted to say that I spent a couple of months in Syria and seeing the conditions there, how the economy was suffering, how people were so scared, how there were limited opportunities. I don't necessarily think the threat of an Islamist government is that bad, because they might actually be better than the dictators that are over there. And personally, I find it kind of offensive when everyone's like, oh, the threat of an Islamist government. We don't know what they're going to be like. They might be better. If the people don't like them, they can vote them out. I think the biggest problem is the U.S. helping the military in the Arab world, even in Pakistan, where they do have a civilian government, but it's very weak because the military is so strong.
Maher, your perspective is really interesting. Let me ask you. If they don't like an Islamic government, they can vote them out. But what about the Iran example? Americans don't know how to think about this exactly, but look at Iran. We have the sense that it's been, we saw uprisings there, and the Islamic government didn't go anywhere. They did not go away.
Well, if we assume that the elections were fair, then maybe that's what the government wanted, and it might be hard for people in the West, but maybe that's what they wanted.
Maybe that's what the people wanted. Is. Yeah, I get
it. You know, that's maybe what democracy is. And if they were rigged, then that's just another example of government failing, or a certain type of failure, which what the dictatorships and monarchies are too. So at least with a democracy, we're headed in the right direction, rather than giving money to these puppet dictators who, you know, where there's very little hope other than with these uprisings, which are so much more difficult.
Maher, I'm very glad for your call. I appreciate Anthony Shadid. If we're riding a great, enormous wave of history here, you know, Rami suggests, and Maher the same, come on. And maybe it's just obvious. Democracy's rising here. The people are going to have more sway. Maybe they want Islamic government. And Maher says it certainly looks better than having your women beaten in the streets by a military supported in part 20%, Shadi says, from outside. Is that inevitable to your eye, Tony Shadi, that we're going to have Islamic governments? And what about that? What does that mean for democracy, for women, the things that Americans tend to get nervous about at that moment?
I think that's the key question. What does it mean? I'm not even sure how we would define Islamic governments at this point. I mean, we can look at a place like Egypt where, you know, in a lot of respects, I think you could define Egypt as already an Islamist state. I mean, there's no question, I think the caller is right, that if we look over the past couple of generations, the wretched record of governance across the Arab world has been at the hands of nominally secular, you know, authoritarian regimes. It has not been Islamist. And I think it was interesting when I was in Egypt covering the election recently, you often heard voters saying, well, let's give the Islamists a chance. Let's see what they can do. They've been the great bogeyman in Arab politics for so long. Now it's their time to, you know, to stand up and deliver. I do have a very strong sense that, you know, while there's a great risk that the kind of most puritanical elements of the Islamist movement drag the mainstream toward the right, in other words, they press these issues of Islamic law, they press these questions of cultural debates, the same kind of cultural debates we see in the United States, that somehow that distracts or that attracts a lot of attention, I still think the Islamist party is going to be first and foremost occupied with how do you build a legitimate state, how do you deal with these overwhelming economic problems, how do you deliver. And I think those challenges are going to be the priorities that these parties face. It's not going to be these questions that are often used as a reason to somehow delegitimize Islamist groups in Arab countries. Now, that may not be the case, but that's my own sense of it, how we go forward.
We wanted to have women's voices here today as well, but people are all over the world and traveling, and we're great. It's great to have you guys. Here's comments online. Margby says, talking about the problems women are having with the military in Egypt, says, if Egypt and other Arab countries persist in treating half their population in such a cavalier manner, which is a nice description of the beatings we saw in Tahrir Square last week, how can things improve? But then John writes, if you think the military is bad, wait until the votes are counted in Egypt and the Islamists take over. What about women and the wave of the Arab Spring, Shadi Hamid? Are they finding their footing? I mean, thousands in the streets of Cairo yesterday, quite an eye-popping display of women coming out in outrage over how at least the one woman and others were disrobed, literally disrobed and beaten in the square.
Yeah, well, these revolutions, you know, I think there was an expectation at the beginning that women would continue playing an important role because they were on the front lines of the initial protests in places like Egypt and elsewhere. That's not the case, and we might very well end up with a parliament in Egypt next month where you literally have two or three women out of more than 450. So unfortunately, it's very difficult for women to get elected in a place like Egypt. It's still very much a patriarchal society. And I don't think Islamists, you know, we have to move away from this alarmism. They're not going to force women to wear the headscarf or prevent women from working. That said, they're not going to be focusing on women's rights either. So it's going to take a long time, and I think it's not about Islamists or not Islamists. It's about culturally ingrained practices and where people don't necessarily feel comfortable with female leadership. But, you know, we have to look at the ordering of this. It took us in the U.S., God knows how long, for women to really reach a comfortable place. Or in Switzerland, where women didn't get the right to vote until the early 1970s. I mean, we can't expect these things to happen overnight. The Egyptians are going to have to debate and struggle with these issues themselves. And they're going to have to work it out. And you know what? We have to accept as well that we're not going to have the same American-style model of gender equality in a place like Egypt probably ever. It's simply a different culture. I don't mean to kind of descend into cultural relativism, but I also don't think it's fair to think that everyone is going to have the same views about the role of women in society.
Rami, let me put a comment to you we have here from Facebook. Linda Kabulian writes in, and she says, I was in Cairo yesterday with the American Bar Association Rule of Law Initiative, helping young Egyptian lawyers to strengthen democracy. She writes, the military is tightly in control, but she says only a subset of the population saw the images from Tahrir Square this weekend when the military cops were beating on protesters there, because state television only delivers the military's position that the protesters are creating chaos, Linda writes, and that, she says, the military's position that the protests are making chaos, and chaos is dangerous to all. I mean, do Egyptians really know what's going on in their own country? Is this wave inevitably going forward? What about a kind of counter-revolution here, or revanchist, rise in response? Maybe the military hangs on here in Bahrain and punches it back down, Rami.
Well, this is exactly what's going on all across the region. I mean, Tunis was an exceptional case where the leadership fled, and the transition was relatively smooth. Egypt is more complicated, and the others are much more violent and drawn out, too. And I think we're going to see this. This is going to take some years with revolutionary impulses, counter-revolutionary ones, rule of law, autocracy. But I just want to add a point about the last point that you and Shadi were talking about when he made some important points, which I want to add, which is that I find that there's a kind of neo-colonial element that's creeping into some of the questions and attitudes from overseas that that we get, and people are saying, well, what's this revolution going to do for women? What's it going to do for Iranians, Israelis, and for this and for that? And nobody asked those questions about any other revolutions around the world. I don't hear anybody asking about Myanmar or the Ukraine or anything. They ask, are these going to be democratic countries? And Arabs should be judged by the level of their commitment to the rule of law, democratic pluralism, majority rights, and minority rights being protected. But people ask the Arabs different questions, and we have to achieve legitimacy in our democratic transition if we abide by certain policies that people in the West or in Israel or in other places like. And this is a new form of neocolonialism, and this is why so many people are still out in the street and will fight this process, because we're simultaneously democratizing, but we're still decolonizing. We're still fighting an anti-colonial battle, and I think there has to be a mindset change in the West, as well as among the leaders in this region.
I mean, this is really interesting. Anthony Shadid, I want to come to you with this. I mean, we were talking with Shadi before the show, and he's saying in the Middle East, whatever we may think in the United States, in the Middle East, his impression is that the perception is that the United States has been on the wrong side of history in this year of the Arab Spring, dragging its feet, not out front, not with the people. And now you've got Rami saying, hey, you know, back off. This is going to be Arab democracy, and whether it looks like you want it to or not, this isn't neocolonialism they want here. You're sitting in Oklahoma, Anthony Shadid, and Americans are accustomed to looking around the world and making judgments about the way they like things to be. Where does this relationship go, the U.S. and the region? Are we just marginalized and out of it?
Well, I mean, I think Rami put it really well. I think that's a great point. The double standards that have been so rife when it comes to, you know, Western relationships with the Arab world are still there, and they're still complicating matters. I think what we have right here is a moment in which I think the United States in particular could step up and signal a shift in its policy toward a region that it is not, that it is, as both of their guests have pointed out, has been on the wrong side time and again. I think when we see where the United States has the most leverage, Egypt and Bahrain in particular, it has not sought to use that leverage to put itself on the right side of history, perhaps. What strikes me, being home just for a few days, though, is that at the very moment that the United States and, you know, perhaps Europe to a lesser extent could signal a decisive shift in how they've handled relations with the region, you see almost no inclination or desire, I think, on the part of, you know, either the public or the government to take that step. And that's striking to me. This feels like a very historic moment when you're, I think, in the Arab world. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's understood. You know, I don't think the depth of the moment is necessarily understood here.
And it's a big, big moment. We'd better get our glasses fully on and paying attention. Ty is calling from Boston. Ty, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a question, a comment for Rami regarding, you know, he lives in Beirut, and I think that the worst kind of uprising and civil war sort of Arab Spring that's been going on for decades over there is actually in Lebanon. And I'm kind of wondering what's going on there, especially now with Hezbollah gaining so much power. And Hezbollah, as everyone knows, is a proxy of Iran, and it's one of the worst terror organizations around. So I'm kind of wondering how that kind of region and that area is playing out. Rami, thank you.
Yeah, Rami?
That requires a whole show, but yes. In a minute I'll just tell you that all of the trends in the Arab world do not apply in Lebanon right now, because all of the Arab rebellions and citizen revolts are against heavy-handed, oppressive central governments. And in the Arab world, that prevails in most places. In Lebanon, the central government is weak, power is diffused, therefore there is no oppressive central government to rebel against. The problems in Lebanon are serious, but they're of a different kind. Hezbollah's strength is an issue that the Lebanese themselves are trying to deal with, and it's going to take a long time to work that out. There are problems of sectarianism, corruption, inefficiency, many serious problems in Lebanon, but an oppressive central government is not one of them.
Tony Shadid, let me throw one more in here. And again, Rami, you're not going to like this, but this is Americans kind of getting up to speed with perhaps with what's going on. Here's a comment from Greg online. He writes, I believe the Arab Spring can trace its roots to the liberation of Iraq. And I assume this means by U.S. troops. And then he writes, it is fragile, the Arab Spring. And without America's leadership, it can all be undone. We very well may see something worse than we had arise in Egypt and Libya. What about that perspective, Tony Shadid?
I mean, I don't share it. I think if anything, the U.S. invasion and occupation that followed, you know, perhaps even delayed the Arab Spring or delayed these Arab revolts. I think, it's hard, I think, for people to watch from afar what actually transpired in Iraq, the destruction of that society's fabric. And we see it even today with, you know, Prime Minister Maliki making a very blatant power grab the minute the American forces leave. It is a country that can take a generation to reconstitute itself, to put itself on the right footing. It's not a record that wants to be emulated anywhere else in the Middle East. I don't agree with that point that the Arab Spring or the Arab revolts need American leadership. I think the Americans want to get on the right side of history, but what's most powerful about this year is an indigenous vocabulary that's been pronounced time and again in country after country. It's societies that are being inherited by the people that live in them. And I think that's what's so inspirational. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be rocky. There's going to be crisis and violence. But there's an entirely different arithmetic at play in the Arab world right now.
Can I jump in on this point?
Yes, please, Shadi.
Yeah, I mean, I take Anthony's point, but at the same time, international factors are very important. I mean, if you look at Libya and now Syria, sometimes indigenous protest movements can't do it on their own. They need someone from the outside to tip the balance one way or the other. And yes, the U.S. is growing more irrelevant, but I'm actually not sure if that's a good thing, because at the end of the day, there are going to be competitors to U.S. influence, whether it's China or Russia. And as bad as the U.S. has been in the Arab world, at least we pretend to care occasionally. The same cannot be said of the Russians and the Chinese.
What would you have the U.S. do in Syria right now?
Well, that's a tough one, but I think more aggressive efforts to bring an international coalition together to put pressure on the Syrian regime, everything and anything short of military methods. You know, I really hope that we don't move in the direction of military intervention, but I really worry that 2012, we might very well see a movement in that direction. And already Syrian activists on the ground are saying, we need help, serious help, just like the Libyans got. I fear that. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see. But as difficult as 2011 has been, 2012, we might see a lot more bloodshed.
Rami Khoury, our time is almost gone. How many years until a, very broadly speaking, a new stable order in your region? 5, 10, 50?
I think within 2 years we will have a significant change in probably 6 or 8 Arab countries, but then this process will evolve over time. The monarchies will evolve into their own form of reformed governance systems. A couple of autocrats will probably hang on as they have in the former Soviet Empire, where democracy was not total. But I think within 2-3 years, we should have a pretty clear situation. We've seen the birth of the Arab citizen. We've seen the birth of Arab politics. We've seen the birth of, you know, historic elements here.
And an indigenous vocabulary. Gentlemen, you are all amazing. Rami, we're out of time. Rami Khoury with the Beirut's Daily Star, Anthony Shadid with the New York Times, Shadi Hamid in Doha, Qatar. Thanks to you all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.